We are 2 weeks and 5 days from Election Day. On Inside, will Dianne Feinstein hold on to her California Senate seat? Will Democrats flip enough House seats to take control? Or did the Republicans hold on to the Senate and the House? Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler is in Southern California. He'll talk with me about the House races. Reporter Nadine Sabai was at yesterday's Feinstein De Leon conversation. We'll talk about some of those key moments. In our second half hour, Timothy Brown, the longtime executive director of Loaves and Fishes, is here today as an author. His new novel, Squatter's Gold, encompasses his experiences with people who are homeless and Sacramento's gold rush history. Later, jazz concerts that you can see starting tonight in Devin Cortan's Jazz Sound Advice. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. If you missed yesterday's midday conversation between California Senator Dianne Feinstein and her opponent, State Senator Kevin De Leon, or if you just want to hear it again, you can find a link at capradio.org. A bit later in the hour, I'll talk with Cap Radio reporter Nadine Sabai, who was in San Francisco for that event yesterday. First, though, let's talk about the House of Representatives. 23 flips of Republican-held House seats would give the Democrats control. Some of those key races are in California, some are in the South, and that's where Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler has been on assignment. He's joining us by phone. Hi, Ben.
Hey, good morning, Beth.
So of the 23, let's talk about how many are closely watched in California. At one time, it was as many as seven. The number isn't that high right now, is it?
I think that's fair to say, and I think that's because both parties privately acknowledge that one seat in each direction has dropped off that list of seven competitive congressional races. The race in the Southern Central Valley, the Hanford area, south of Fresno, north of Bakersfield, currently held by David Valadao. Democrats canceled their TV ad buy in earlier this week, and that's a clear signal that they are saying, we don't think we're going to be able to defeat David Valadao. Valadao defeated his Democratic challenger in the primary, TJ Cox, by a nearly 2-to-1 margin. And that's just a lot of votes for a Democratic candidate to be able to come back from in a district like that, especially in a non-presidential election year. So it's likely that that one is off the table, that Republicans are going to hold it. On the Democratic side, it looks like Democrats are in good position to pick up the northern San Diego, southern Orange County congressional seat currently held by the retiring House Republican member Daryl Issa. That's a race pitting Republican Board of Equalization member Diane Harkey against a Democratic challenger Mike Levin, who emerged, both emerged from crowded packs of in the primary to be the two candidates in here. And of all of the competitive congressional races in California, this district was the only one where Democratic votes combined in the June primary outnumbered Republican votes combined. And it is generally acknowledged that Democrats are more likely to vote in general elections than in primary elections, that there's more growth on the Democratic side than the Republican side. So this district is being seen as a pretty safe Democratic pickup at this point. Although, of course, caveats, anything can and often does happen in these races. Polls showing the Democratic candidate Mike Levin with a significant lead there, and Republicans aren't really investing outside resources in that race.
So that leaves us, I'm going to name these by district for people who want to keep an eye specifically on the numbers. If we look at those five, it leaves us with districts 10, 25, 39, 45, and 48 as being the key toss-up districts at this point, right?
I think that's right, yeah. And if you want, we can go through them individually or just talk about them as a group.
I do want to say that District 48, for example, was isolated as maybe being a tipping point district, if you follow Nate Silver's 538, meaning where are we going to get an indication that this flip could be nationwide? And so let's start with District 48. Spend some time there, Ben.
Well, that is the district currently held by Republican Dana Rohrabacher. It's coastal Orange County, stretching from Huntington Beach at the northern part of the county down past Newport Beach, Laguna Beach, down to the, you know, Dana Point area as well. And it's currently considered a toss-up, I think, by the Cook Political Report. And it's an interesting district to watch for this reason. Of all the House Republicans from California, the one most closely aligned publicly and stylistically with President Trump is, I think, Dana Rohrabacher. He's been speaking very favorably about Russia and of course, certainly about the president as well. And Democrats have gone after Rohrabacher as being kind of out there, kind of loony, kind of crazy. The challenger, Harley Ruda, the Democrat, is a more moderate Democrat. Democrats are optimistic about him fitting that district fairly well. He does have some personal baggage that Republicans, outside groups, have been hitting him on. And his numbers appear to have maybe taken a little bit of a slide. But at this point, it seems both parties acknowledge that this one could go either way.
All right. Staying in the South, then, let's talk a bit about Southern Orange County, District 45.
And that one is currently held by Republican Mimi Walters. Her challenger is Democrat Katie Porter, who we caught up with last night at a phone banking event at our campaign headquarters. And we're going to be seeing many of the other candidates, too. We also caught up with a Republican candidate in another nearby district that we can talk about in a bit, too. And Porter, unlike Harley Ruda challenging Rohrabacher, Porter is running, is staking out positions generally seen as more on the liberal end of the Democratic Party. She is for Medicare for all, for example. And she is, you know, when I interviewed her last night, she was speaking very much more about Mimi Walters than about President Trump, criticizing Mimi Walters much more than President Trump, although she did criticize Walters for standing with Trump on votes like the repealing Obamacare and the Republican tax overhaul. So we will see to what extent that works. What's interesting is to contrast Mimi Walters from Dana Rohrabacher, right? So Walters, unlike Rohrabacher, kind of keeps her head down. She isn't really far out there opposing President Trump or supporting President Trump. She's just kind of there as a member of Congress. She's influential. She has leadership aspirations, but she hasn't really staken out clear ground vocally on one side of the president or another. And she's been in this district for a while as a state senator before a member of Congress. And so if you're looking if you're looking at this, you know, swing group of voters who voted for their Republican member of Congress 2 years ago but did not vote for Donald Trump, either leaving President blank, voting for Libertarian Gary Johnson, or voting for Democrat Hillary Clinton, and there is a sizable group of these swing voters in each of these Southern California congressional districts, how do you get them to change their minds if you're a Democrat? How do you get them to say, right, I dislike Donald Trump so much that I'm going to vote to cast my party out of power in the House of Representatives and make Nancy Pelosi Speaker again? I think it is more possible that a disenchanted, never-Trump Republican might not vote for Dana Rohrabacher than leave off Mimi Walters. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you know, I don't have any evidence to back this up. This is just kind of looking at it at a glance, and this is kind of the thesis we're going to try to test out as we talk to voters in districts over the next couple of days. But it seems plausible that a voter who is disenchanted with Trump might also be disenchanted with Rohrabacher. Less plausible is that a loyal, longtime Republican disenchanted with Trump is also disenchanted with Mimi Walters.
I'm talking with Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler, who is in Southern California on assignment. We are talking about the House races. If 23 across the country flip, then the Democrats, 23 Republican-held seats, the Democrats would take control. Ben, I want you to wrap up talking about two other Southern California districts, 25 and 39. They're both toss-up districts. To what degree in each of them?
Yeah, I think we'll start with the 39th because we're right now down in Orange County, and that's the Eastern Orange County area, Fullerton, Brea. Republican Young Kim, a former assembly member and former congressional staffer to the retiring Republican who holds that seat, Ed Royce, is running against Democrat Gil Cisneros, a lottery winner. And that one, folks seem to think, tips a little bit. Well, it's a toss-up. Republicans are feeling, I think, a little bit better about that race right now than Democrats are. It's the other way around in District 25. That's the northern Los Angeles County suburbs like Santa Clarita. And where I think Democrats are feeling a little bit better about that race than Republicans are right now. The incumbent there, Republican Steve Knight, is seen as a bit of a weaker candidate than someone like Mimi Walters. Whereas the Democratic candidate, Katie Hill, is seen as being a very good candidate on the Democratic side. And so I think these two are good to pair together because I think while they're both toss-ups, I think one party feels better about one seat and the other party feels better about the other seat.
Right. Before we leave this part of the conversation, let's say something about the district in the north, District 10, because people up in our area are seeing a bombardment of Josh Harder and Jeff Denham ads.
Yes, we are.
We don't see the Southern California race ads, of course, the way you are, but in the north, this is an intense battle.
You've actually reminded me that I need to turn on the local TV news while
you
I'm
should.
Here to get all these TV ads.
Definitely.
Usually when I get back to my hotel room, I'm done for the night. But I guess we're always working. This is a toss-up, and it's a very different kind of race from all of the others because it's not suburban. All of the others are suburban, and Democrats think they have a really strong shot in many suburban districts where well-educated voters are really struggling with President Trump. In the Central Valley, a more rural area, I think that's a case where, although you've got business groups and of course farmers who are very concerned about the president's immigration policy, that it is a little bit more Trump country or a lot more Trump country than the suburbs in Orange County and Los Angeles County. And so, in theory, longtime Republican Congressman Jeff Denham, himself a farmer, represents the district well, has had moderate words on immigration, although he has voted with the president to repeal Obamacare and for the Republican tax plan. He ought to be seen perhaps as having a decent shot. The Democratic candidate, Josh Harder, is mounting a strong campaign, has a lot of money, and outside groups are backing him as well. And so this one is seen as a toss-up. Harder has been seen as having a bit of a lead in some polling. But I think Republicans are feeling, look, if Republican voters, loyal Republican voters, come home, if they say, hey, we've been a little reluctant to vote in this race or to say we're supporting a member of Congress, we're kind of frustrated or disenchanted, but if they come home and say, yes, I'm going to vote like I usually do, yes, I'm going to vote for my member of Congress like I have in the past, then Republicans think they're going to be okay. And Democrats aren't convinced that's going to happen. And so we'll find out in, less than 3 weeks.
I am seeing polls, Ben, and contrast this with anything that you're seeing, that putting the likelihood that Democrats win control of the House at a pretty high percentage, somewhere in the 80s in terms of percentage.
So, yeah, I think if you look at, Nate Silver's analysis and the Cook Political Report also seems to think Democrats have a very good chance. Now, there's a couple of caveats that I would give that, just cautions. And one is, if we look back at 2016, a lot of the same folks were, and by the same percentages, were giving not just Donald Trump the same paltry odds of winning the presidency, but they were giving the Chicago Cubs the same paltry odds of coming back from a 3-1 World Series deficit to the Cleveland Indians. I think I saw Nate Silver point out, after the Cubs had come back to win their first World Series championship in more than 100 years, that their odds to come back from 3-1 were the same as the president's odds are.
Wow.
And this was just at that point, a couple days before the election. And so we really just don't know. We really don't know.
Well, that
and the
does...
other caveat, the other quick caveat is that there's been evidence nationwide that Republicans have been energized by the Brett Kavanaugh battle on Capitol Hill. And local polls are going to be trailing indicators of that because national polls happen much more quickly and frequently than local polls.
It does feed into some press releases I've seen this week from the John Cox campaign saying that he's seeing a surge in numbers and that could be this overall Republican push, or was there any bump, any result from the debate that happened last week? Did you see anything that was directly correlated?
That is not something I'd be comfortable saying, simply because you want to compare poll to poll, the same poll to the same poll from a different month. Like, for example, you want to compare the Public Policy Institute of California poll to the next Public Policy Institute of California poll. And what we had this week was an LA Times poll showing Newsom with a much larger lead than a recent PPIC poll showed. PPIC had Newsom with roughly a 12-point lead that was much narrower than it was after the primary. The LA Times poll, I believe, and I haven't seen the exact numbers, but my understanding is it had a very wide lead for Gavin Newsom, much more than 12 points. And, you know, you have to look at those methodologies. You have to look at the way the polls were conducted online versus on the phone. You have to look at how pollsters weighted the results to reflect their best estimates of who will and will not vote. And so I think a better comparison would be if we get another PPIC poll, because the one showing a 12-point margin was before the debate. If we get another one between now and the election day,
right? Yeah,
then I think we're going to have a chance of seeing whether the debate had an impact. The Cox campaign, the release they were sending out, they were trying to push back against jumping to conclusions based on that poll showing Cox severely trailing.
All right. So we were talking about the California governor's race in that chance or in that discussion. I think let's wrap up with something quick that sets us up for our next segment, Ben. And you know where I'm going with this. This is the status of California's U.S. Senate race, the Feinstein de Leon race.
And they debated for the first, if you call it a debate, first and only time yesterday at the Public Policy Institute of California, the San Francisco-based think tank. And it was funny. Sally Schilling, our great podcast producer, and I, we landed at the Orange County Airport, and the first thing we did is we went, found a coffee shop where we could watch, or at least I could watch, the Senate debate. And so I saw some of it, but Nadine, who was there, I'm going to leave to her to talk about. It's a race where, again, you've got Feinstein generally showing a pretty big lead. De Leon, running from her left, has a lot of the support that he is getting in polls coming from Republicans who probably aren't aware that he is running to the left of Dianne Feinstein, that he is the author of the Sanctuary State Bill. And if they're aware of that, they are probably not going to vote for either candidate. And so the question is, well, can De Leon make up enough ground against Feinstein among Democrats and among independents? And if he is trying to, he needed a huge audience for a debate. He didn't get it. And so I think most conventional wisdom right now is that Feinstein is poised to win re-election.
All right, Ben, we will take a break and talk to Nadine. But meanwhile, thank you for your reporting from Southern California.
Yeah, and thanks for having me. Hopefully my voice comes back before too long.
All right. Well, thank you, Ben. That is our Capital Bureau Chief, Ben Adler. And you're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. I think it was more of a conversation. Maybe there were moments of debate, or at least moments of response, but yesterday, Dianne Feinstein and Kevin De Leon sat down in San Francisco at the Public Policy Institute for a broadcast event. This is the only one of their campaign against each other to be elected U.S. Senator, and the only time Dianne Feinstein has debated a challenger since the year 2000. Cap Radio reporter Nadine Sabai was at the event. She's joining us by phone from San Francisco. Hi, Nadine.
Hi, Beth.
Do you want to start with an overall main takeaway from this event? And I think this was your first experience at a political debate on this level.
Yes, it was. And I was expecting a debate, and I did not get that. As you had mentioned, this truly was a conversation. Both Senator Feinstein and State Senator De Leon were very cordial with one another. The main takeaway from this event is that the two Democrats agree on a lot, from how to deal with climate change to the Delta Tunnels project. But Senator De Leon tried to separate himself by being the candidate that will shake things up in Washington. He wants to reform sexual misconduct in Congress, fight the Republican-led administration with hand and fist, and enact climate change reforms.
So because you're saying that, we have a clip from the debate in which De Leon is talking about how he decided to take his own leadership position. So let's listen to this from yesterday.
Back in 2016, November 8th, late at night, I had made a decision, somewhat controversial, even among some Democrats, that I would help lead the resistance, because I think that we have to do everything within our power to protect our economic prosperity, to protect our values, and to protect our people. Unfortunately, this president has not held back. He said very clearly he was going to come after our immigrant families. He said very clearly that he was going to unravel any climate change progress by pulling out of the Paris Accords. It's very clearly that he went after Muslims with the Muslim ban, by going after California's fuel efficiency standards. It's very clear what this president set out to do. And unfortunately, sadly, he's been quite successful. And it's been California who's been the leading voice for the entire nation. And that's why the world looks towards California for leadership, not towards Washington, D.C., on the issue of climate change, on the issue of immigration reform, because there's been inaction in Washington, D.C., because it's so deeply dysfunctional.
In that soundbite, you really hear him positioning himself and California against the Trump administration. But it was clear, Nadine, as a listener, and I watched it online, that his strategy is to include Dianne Feinstein in that inaction and then point out specifically where she wasn't or didn't do enough, that kind of approach.
Exactly. He never mentioned Senator Feinstein by name. Instead, he would just mention the Democrats in Congress, and I think that that was his way of trying to jab at her a little bit. And what he is trying to pull himself as is this person that is not a veteran in the federal government, and that he can come in just like Donald Trump came in and shake things up, but for the Democratic side.
It was noted that we're in the midst of this one-year anniversary of We Said Enough and the Me Too movement. And with that, the question went to, as was expected, Senator Dianne Feinstein to respond to the Kavanaugh hearings, the confirmation process, and the fact that she received this letter and held it confidentially for so long. I'm going to pick up part of her long comments where she talks ultimately about her decision in the Kavanaugh confirmation.
I did not vote for Mr. Kavanaugh to be a member of the Supreme Court. As the ranking member, I argued against it to the best of my ability and argued on the floor against it. I think that as long as appointments are made in the way they're made, which is the president has the authority to make a judicial appointment, and we either, it's an advise and consent process. The problem is there's very little advice when the parties are different in the executive branch than they are in the legislative branch. There isn't the amount of consultation that would go on if this were a Democratic president with Democrats on the committee. And I think everybody can probably understand that.
And that emphasizes, I think, Nadine, the way she needed to respond to some of the national positions on national issues, but also answer to the California voters who want to know more and expect her to be a certain way because she's being elected in this state.
That's right. And I think she had constantly tried to portray herself as the person who has been in government for a very long time. And particularly with this event, she wanted to clear her name, that she was going to keep Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's letter confidential, that she wanted to enact stricter reforms, and that she did the right thing. And I remember during the event, I was looking around the room when the senator was talking about this, and people were nodding their heads in agreement, kind of more in support of her than anything else.
Let's hear one more piece of the debate, and this speaks to what you were saying, Nadine, about them being in agreement. They are two Democrats. This seat will remain a Democratic seat, and there certainly were things they see from the same point of view.
I actually think we're in agreement.
Okay.
I did the assault weapons legislation that was law for 10 years. I was the author of it. Before I went to the Senate, there was a shooting in 101 California Street, and a large number of people, I think everybody here probably knows that, were killed. And I thought, well, the time has come to really take weapons of war off the streets. And we wrote the bill, and it was law. The only way I could get it through, Kevin, was with a sunset of 10 years, which we did. And the numbers began to drop over time. And unfortunately, the bill sunset. I've introduced a second bill with Senator Murphy, and we have, I think, over 40 co-sponsors on it, improving it as we could. That bill will go nowhere in a Republican-dominated Senate and House. And that's reason to change things so we can do something.
And that sets up the hope that Democrats will have some power. But Nadine, speak to that a little bit about this idea of agreement and the atmosphere overall for these two competitors who, in some respects, aren't that far apart, in others are very wide apart.
Right. Well, this clip that you just pulled is a perfect example of what Senator Feinstein's position was during this entire conversation. She named De Leon by name in this instance, talking about gun violence, which has obviously defined her career. And she was trying to showcase that, you know, you can protest and say that you're going to fight and you do all these things once you get in government. But the reality is, this is how things work. I don't know how many times throughout this conversation, Senator Feinstein mentioned the idea that she is in the minority. Democrats are in the minority, and there's only so much that she can do. And she was saying that in response to De Leon, who was saying, you know, Democrats aren't doing enough and these sorts of things. And she was being the more realistic person, so to speak.
All right. Well, I know you're filing more reports. I'm going to refer people to the website, especially to find the link and listen to the entire debate. But needless to say, having a conversation like this, I don't know where you stand on this, but I think it's helpful, Nadine. And it's interesting, too, wasn't it?
It was really interesting. And I think it gave me a sense of relief, to be honest with you. Just to have two people having a conversation about the issues that they care about and not this sparring back and forth with one another. It was really great. Mm. And also the room was really kind of small and intimate. There were 12 television cameras behind me trying to fit in this small space. But from the beginning, the moderator, PPIC's Mark Baldessari, told the audience not to clap and to leave it to the end. They truly wanted to make this kind of an intimate space, and I think they succeeded in that. Hmm.
All right, Nadine, thanks for your reporting today.
Thank you, Beth.
That is Cap Radio reporter Nadine Sabai from San Francisco. That link is at capradio.org, and this is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Tim Brown is a name you might know from many years of dedicated social work in Sacramento. He was executive director of the nonprofit Loaves and Fishes. He was a founding board member of the Sacramento Homeless Organizing Committee. And in 2011, he was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the National Association of Social Workers, California chapter. In 2012, after semi-retiring, he says, Timothy became a member of the Loretto Writers Collective, and he has now released his first novel. It was published by nfbpublishing.com. It's titled Squatter's Gold, and he's here in the studio as an author. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Beth, for having me.
It's so great to see you again after so many years. This book speaks to your life work, to your experience on a few different levels. So what does it mean to you to have it published?
It meant a lot. It's pretty difficult to get a publisher these days. It took quite a while. I spent 5 years on it. It's kind of my baby. And to get it out there is a big deal, you know, after all that.
With the title Squatter's Gold, people can imagine that it does combine some of the gold rush history. It is a somewhat fictionalized beginning in the true history of the squatters' riots. We can talk a bit about that. Then there are characters in the more modern part of the book inspired by people you know and the legend of The tree, the lost gold hidden in a tree. So start with the squatters' riots and why that fascinated you.
Yeah, I did a lot of research. I'd always been fascinated by it. And, you know, it's kind of the history of homelessness in Sacramento, at least as a settlement. And, you know, it was the beginning of the boom bust thing, which still happens, you know, and of homelessness. So I thought it was relevant to what we're doing today. And a lot of people didn't, a lot of mostly guys didn't find gold and ended up back in Sacramento, and there was not a lot of work, and they were squatting on what was then, you know, private land in the hands of just a few people, and, you know, came down to violent riots, you know, so it fascinated me, I think. And then I tried to make it entertaining, putting in the gold, the hidden gold in the tree. And I'm a big fan of both historic fiction and urban mystery. So I combined a couple genres.
It's real, right? You have a picture of the tree in the book.
The tree is real. It's one of my favorite trees.
Can you draw comparisons of homelessness then in the gold rush times to homelessness in the contemporary era?
Somewhat. I mean, there's obvious differences, but I mean, it was boom and bust and land speculation threw the prices up so high that people couldn't afford land unless you found a lot of gold, and most people didn't. And so they were stranded here and trying to make the best of it and camping out, just like we have campers today on public land mostly. And they were accosted by the government and evicted, or, you know, they attempted to evict people. And in that case, you know, it was 150 years ago, they fought back. And so it was unfortunate that quite a few people lost their lives in that. The mayor, the sheriff eventually, the leaders, one of the leaders of the squatters. And really a fascinating time. And I tried to tell the story through my character, and I hope I pulled that off.
The book is authentic. It is really entertaining and well-written. But it's authentic because you know the landscape of people's lives from when they're getting high on the streets to when they're camping and being moved. There's a murder that happens. There's a number of violent scenes that happen in the book, and all the way to the courtroom when they're charged with violations and they have to navigate the legal system. So are your characters composites of real-life people and situations?
Absolutely. You know, I have, from 30 years, a head full of homeless people. I've met hundreds, even thousands, and some I've gotten to know pretty well. The murder scene was actually based on a real murder that was actually never solved, of a person who was deaf that I knew, who was hearing impaired. And so I, you know, I kind of used that as a part of the book. But and the camping scenes, you know, I've just seen so many. I've been to so many camps and met so many campers and tried to help so many folks. And so it was, for me, one of the fun parts of the book is really pulling together these characters and the villains, for that matter. I mean, and I really wanted to make homeless people fully human. You know, there's a lot of dehumanization. They get called transients and bums and winos and trolls. And I thought one of my key goals was to humanize people, and because they are like you and I. They're fathers, lovers, brothers, you know, heroes and villains, you know. So I tried to tell the good, the bad, and the ugly.
There's a character, Jake, who's really come up front and throughout the book is trying to reconcile his past and his mistakes. And near the end of the book, he's talking with Skip, a local musician.
Yeah.
And by the way, people who've been in Sacramento a long time are going to recognize a lot of what's in there, even the fictionalized version of it. But he is talking in a very human way about the pain. And those areas of the book made me realize, until we can see and understand and maybe connect with some of the pain, we don't fully humanize the experience of someone we might just see in a blur.
Absolutely. I mean, one of my subtexts of the book was grief and loss, you know, which is so prevalent among the homeless population and among those trying to help them. I mean, You know, when I was at Loaves and Fishes, it was my dream job. But that job, when you're up and so close to homelessness and personal, that it really takes a toll on people. And you know, I preached self-care to many people over the years that I mentored and tried to practice it. But, it, you know, it caught up to me eventually. And it's just a reality of that work. You're up against so much grief. And, you know, back then we averaged about every 10 days a memorial service for a homeless person. Those are just the people we knew at Loaves and Fishes. We have a memorial wall with hundreds of names. And so many people pass. And there's a lot of grief around that and loss. And on the other hand, so many people get better and become staff people and, you know, work in homeless programs and get their lives back together. So it's you know, both sides, but the grief is a big one.
You're listening to Tim Brown. He is an expert on the community treatment of mental illness and addiction, as well as homelessness. He's published reports and given expert testimony to superior courts, local governments, and the California legislature. We are talking about his first novel, Squatter's Gold, Book One of the Sam White Homeless Mysteries. I don't have to draw too dark a line between Timothy Brown and Sam White. It just sort of appears there. Very obvious. There's a book reading and signing happening this Saturday from 5 to 7 p.m. at Luna's Cafe. If you haven't seen Tim for a while, if you just want to support the book or support all the work he's done around the issue of homelessness in the community, again, Luna's Cafe, 5 to 7 o'clock. Ask him to tell you about some of his great characters like Gremlin, Snake, Bandana, Cat. You have Batman and Robin in there, too. How many books in this series do you have mapped out in your head?
I'm working on a second one about a third of the way. Other than that, I'm not so sure. But since I call it a series, I have to at least do two. But,
right. Yeah. Why did you write this one?
You know, I felt like I had a story to tell about homelessness. And Sacramento is a place I've lived for 35 years and loved. And I wanted to tell a Sacramento story about homelessness. But also, again, people read for entertainment. So I really wanted to tell an interesting story that caught people's attention.
Well, as I said, the reality of it is very palpable. The characters are very real. Does that experience of your life live with you now in any other way than in your writing?
Interesting question. Well, I'm still in touch with, I still go to Loaves and Fishes and still in touch with a lot of people doing advocacy work. I haven't been in the forefront of that for a few years, but yeah, it's hard to leave. I mean, and when you write a book, it's constantly going through your head and, you know, what parts of it should I tell and what not, and what parts changed me that, you know, those are the parts that I think touch people. Mm. And a lot of that's relationships with homeless people I've met who are just amazingly resilient, you know, with disabilities and single moms with kids and people, very low income people for the most part, and very disabled. And again, we lose a lot of people, but we help a lot of folks too. And Sacramento, when I was at Loaves and Fishes, seeing the generosity of Sacramento, you know, it's just a very humbling experience because there's so many supporters, thousands and thousands of people volunteer and support. And that is just really special, I think. The really positive side and the really tough side of loss and grief, you know, that's constantly in your face doing that work.
Well, you have a quote from Mayor Daryl Steinberg in the opening of the book that speaks to both the humanitarian crisis of homelessness and the blessing that Sacramento has in so many people being willing to look at it, work at it, and make it a human problem and believe that there's a solution. So,
yeah, and Daryl's been a real leader as mayor.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
On this next chapter of your life, so to speak.
It.
Book two, I'll be looking forward to it and looking forward to our next conversation, okay?
Great. Thank you, Beth.
Timothy Brown, again, Saturday, 5 to 7 p.m. at Luna's Cafe in Sacramento. The book is Squatter's Gold. It's book number one of the Sam White Homeless Mysteries. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. There are some terrific opportunities to see live jazz in the region this month. Cap Radio's jazz host Devin Cortan talked with me about some concert ideas, and that's in this week's Sound Advice. I asked him, how soon can we hear those concerts?
We can see jazz in your neighborhood right now tonight.
Yeah.
You can see it tonight.
Okay. Where do you want to start?
And starting at the Sophia Sakopoulos Center for the Arts. It's the new B Street Theater facility. It's beautiful on Capitol.
Right.
And they are putting on a great show tonight, a guitarist, Stanley Jordan. This guy has been on the scene for years. He is considered to be sort of a legend. He got signed to Blue Note Records in the 80s when he was just 24 years old. And what strikes so many people about his playing is his unique approach to the guitar. I'm a guitarist, so this is totally crazy to me. But what he does, instead of placing his finger on the fretboard and picking the string with his other hand, he actually presses down with both of his hands on the fretboard, and just the sheer force of him pressing down on the fretboard makes the sound. So he can use all of his fingers on the fretboard.
Wow.
So he doesn't pluck the strings. What I wanted to play for you was a recording he made a long time ago in 1998. It's a record he recorded for Blue Note called Live in New York. And the cut I chose is John Coltrane's Impressions. And it really showcases his virtuosity, especially considering his unique approach to this instrument.
Will you explain again now that we've heard the music?
Yeah, you can hear the staccato nature of what he's playing.
The pluckiness.
Yeah, but he's actually hammering what we call a hammer-on. He's hammering on his fingers onto the fretboard to produce the sound instead of placing your finger one hand on the fretboard.
Curved around the guitar neck.
And then plucking the string with your other hand with your pick or your finger. But no, it's just the sheer force of him placing his finger on the string on the fretboard that produces the sound.
Perfect example of why you want to see music played live.
Yes.
So that show is tonight.
Tonight at the Sophia at 7. And I will see you there if you go. I'll be bringing Stanley and the band on. And I'm really excited to do it. He is great. I've wanted to see him forever.
Okay. Let's keep moving because you're going to preview another show coming up at the Sophia.
That's right. The Sophia is bringing in a lot of high-profile jazz these days, and we're going to move on to Karin Allison. She is one of the most in-demand singers right now. Her bio on her website says that she spends two-thirds of the year traveling around the world, and she's coming to our town, Sacramento, at the Sophia Thursday, October 25th at 7. She has a great new record out called Some of That Sunshine, and it's her first record, which is sort of unusual for a jazz artist, that features all original music. And the tune I chose is this really beautiful tune called Just As Well. And when I heard it, I thought it was an old jazz standard written in the 40s from the old American songbook. And that's what really struck me about it. The beauty that I think that has a lot of depth, really relatable yet heartbreaking lyrics. It's really, really lovely.
It's just as well. You don't love me like I love you. It's just as well. You don't want me like I want you. To laugh, to think we'd ever be. I'd love you so. You'd simply have to love me back, you know. Then I'd have to keep some track of every day and every hour missing you.
Wow. I love her voice.
I know. She is one of those people that just seeps music. She is just one of those musical minds. She actually got a degree in classical piano performance. Mm. And pretty soon after that, she got signed to Concord Records for her jazz singing. So she's just this all-around wonderful musician. And she's coming to the Sophia Sakopoulos Center for the Arts on Thursday, October 25th. It's going to be a really great show. I can't wait.
Her name is Karin Allison, K-A-R-R-I-N. So was that not an old song?
No, it wasn't. And that's what I thought. It sounds straight out of a 1940s yeah. Broadway musical. But no, that was her own tune. And that whole record is, in fact, her own original music. And it's just fantastic.
Beautiful. I am talking with Cap Radio's jazz host, Devin Cortan, who is also a musician, MCs a number of jazz events throughout the city. When you said that Stanley Jordan was playing a John Coltrane recording from 1998, you said, long ago, which from my perspective says, you're a young guy. You are a young guy.
That's true. I'm a young jazz fanatic. I guess 1998, yeah, 20 years ago. That's most of
my life. Someday that won't be so long ago, Devin. So let's go on. Who is next?
So the 2018 Brubeck Festival is coming to the University of the Pacific yet again, and it coincides with the 60th anniversary of Dave Brubeck's ambitious jazz diplomacy tour of 1958, where Dave and the band went all through Asia and Europe. The University of the Pacific, they've chose a lot of great international acts to come and showcase at their festival. And one is one of my very favorite musicians right now, Cyrille Aimée. She is a singer from France. She did big things in New York City for a long time. Now she actually just moved to New Orleans, and she'll be performing at the University of the Pacific on Friday the 26th at 7:30. I'm particularly excited for this concert because not only will I be there at the show bringing on the band, but I'll be in the band playing with Siri and the guys. It's going to be a really good time. I'm very, very excited.
You're picking up the guitar that night?
Yep, I will be playing the guitar in the band.
Oh,
yes.
That's great. Well, let's listen to a bit of music.
Let's get lost in each other's arms. Let's get lost. Let them send out alarms. And though they'll think it's rather rude, let's show the world we're in that crazy mood. Let's defrost in a romantic mist. Let's get crossed off everybody's list and celebrate this night we have each other. Ooh, let's get lost.
That's Siri Aimée with the title track from her last record, Let's Get Lost. That's a great old tune made famous by Chet Baker in the early 50s. And that's, of course, called Let's Get Lost. And I love the way that she sings that because the first part, the verse, is kind of like, oh, the party's kind of dull, yada, yada. You get some of these interesting tones, evokes boredom and confusion. And then you go into the really happy swinging part where she's just hanging out with the person she loves. And I love how she arranged that and sings that. And Siri will be at the Brubeck Festival October 26th. That's a Friday. I hope to see you there. I'll be emceeing and also in the band, so I'm really excited for that concert.
This is so much fun. You have such an old jazz soul in you, don't you? All right, so we have time for one more.
This is also happening at the Brubeck Festival. This is on the 27th. It's a Saturday, and this is the Spanish Harlem Orchestra from New York City. And Beth, I got to tell you, this band is in maximum party mode all the time. I encourage you to bring your dancing shoes, and so does the Brubeck Festival, because this band is that much fun. They've been around for almost 20 years. They've played in Sacramento before, and I've seen them, and I can tell you that just the sound and the force of this band is incredible. And this is a tune called La Fiesta Empezó, which is actually like a call to get this party started. So let's hear it.
So that was Devin Cortan bringing us this week's sound advice. Again, back to the first selection, guitarist Stanley Jordan is at the Sophia in Midtown Sacramento tonight. The show starts at 7. On our website, there is a terrific listing of classical and jazz concerts in the area. October 26th, for example, has 7 different options. So we'll post a link to that. You can find it on the music website. And that's Insight for this week. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today is Anthony Van Hook. Thanks again to Devin Cortan, Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr, and thanks for joining us.